righty.
One, two, three, four, five. Oof, oof.
Not good. Not good. Is what it is, though. All right. What was I going to say? Papers, papers, papers. But I'll say that at the end, because I'm sure people will come late. So we're talking about huge, significant religious revolution that would take place in Europe. That, of course, everything that we've talked about is all interrelated. This is one of the reasons why, for example, the kings felt emboldened to ignore the church and start doing global expansion. Kings started declaring war on one another without going to the church asking permission, because there was a complete ecclesiastical breakdown. The church, which once ruled over Europe like an emperor, essentially lost control, and individuals within the society felt free to do as they wished. Well, the church did try pushing back. The church did launch a counter-reformation. But of course, in the counter-reformation, they ran up with against the reasons why Luther, for example, was successful. You know, at the end of the day, he proposed an alternative, and some people bought into that. And once they converted, or left the church, they weren't going back. But then there were the Catholic states that wanted to keep control. So you have one group that wants something and another group wants another, and there is no compromise. In the end, there would be war. Now, for those of you who hate history or are bored with history, one of the reasons that I've always been fascinated about it is simply because of the lessons that can be learned. I think I told you back on the first day, human beings have always been the same. This whole focus on modern ideas, modern values, nothing new. People have thought the same, acted the same way since time immemorial. The only thing is that the problems that we have today, they figured out solutions to and sought to fix them. Whereas today we think we're special and we ignore how they figured things out. And we're trying to do it our own way. But eventually human beings will get back along the same path as we always do. But the path to get there is bumpy, because people today think they are more intelligent. They know more than the people in the past. The sad thing is a lot of the bad things that go on in our daily lives could be avoided simply by looking backwards. Of course, the funny thing is the people in the past had the same problem. They kept making the same mistakes over and over and over again. And this sequence is going to be a good example of what took place over the span of about 150 odd years. And had the people looked backwards, they could have avoided what occurred, which ultimately was death, violence, and destruction. Because the very first war of religion was small. It encompassed a series of two wars that historians collectively refer to as the Swiss Civil War. Like the name implies, the people of Switzerland went to war against themselves. Because one group thought one way, and another group thought another. And they were unwilling to compromise. Now, technically, to be precise, these two wars are known as the First and Second Wars of Capel. All right. The wars were triggered by Zwingli. Zwingli, when he created his Reformation, wanted to reform the churches in Switzerland to follow his militaristic lines. Now, some of the provinces, which the Swiss call cantons, embraced Zwingli's ideas, embraced his reforms. But others wanted by choice to stay Catholic. Unfortunately, when Zwingli couldn't get his way and convert everyone, he established a military union amongst the Protestant cantons, and they literally would try to force the Catholics to convert at sword point. Now, the First War of Cappel is boring. It ended without any bloodshed. Rather than fighting, the leaders decided to negotiate an outcome, because one army moved onto the battlefield across another army. And the leaders decided, you know something? We're all Swiss. It would be stupid if we kill each other, because it's not like we're Muslims or Jews or Hindus. You know, we're all the same. We're all Christians. So let's see if we can come up with a compromise. They negotiated an agreement. The Catholics could stay Catholic, but they could not make an alliance with any outside power, because that wouldn't be fair. If the Protestants made an alliance with the Protestant nations, they could bring armies in, just like what we talked about what happened in Italy. The Swiss weren't dumb. They studied the school of Europe. They saw what happens when the Italians brought in outside countries. The wars became violent. Tens of thousands of people died. And the Swiss didn't want to die. So they agreed, you can keep your faith, no more alliance. Unfortunately, just 2 years later, the Second War was triggered when the Protestants, who were the majority, decided to force the Catholic states, the cantons, to allow Protestant masses. So in other words, we're going to let you be Catholic, but you have to do our masses. And the Catholics said no. And ultimately, that attack on their independence is what triggered the second. So the Protestants started the war by putting a food embargo in place. They literally blocked the flow of food into the Catholic regions. Well, if you deprive someone food, that's an act of war. So the Catholics retaliated. During October and November, armies began meeting face to face on the battlefield and engaging in contact. Thousands of Swiss would die, including Zwingli. FYI, during the battle when Zwingli was killed, the Catholics scooped him up, tied his corpse to a stake, and burned it. Not once, not twice, but thrice. And threw his ashes in the river, because they claimed he was a heretic. Now, ironically, even though the Protestants had the advantage in the First War, the Catholics managed to have the advantage in the Second. The irony was that, like I said, the Catholics were the minority. There were 5 Catholic cantons out of 13. But because the Catholics were better organized, they managed to beat the larger forces. But in the end, after all of the death, all of the destruction, and pretty much once Zwingli was gone, because he was the primary instigator, Catholic leaders sat down with the Protestant leaders and they decided fighting over biblical interpretation was dumb. So they made a settlement. The cantons would decide their own religion. Give the people a choice. The principle upon which the Wars of Kapel ended is this concept right here. Cuius regeo, eos religio. Cuius regeo, eos religio. Whose rule, his religion. Whose rule, his religion. Essentially, it would be the governments that would determine the religion of the state. So, the Catholic cantons were ruled by Catholic leaders, so those states would be Catholic. The Protestant cantons were ruled by Protestants, so the religion in those cantons would be Protestantism. This settlement would be the last time the Swiss would ever, all the way up to today, would go to war with one another. Because they learned, after just a few thousand people died, that it was stupid. Because divided we stand, united we united we stand, divided we fall. Got it backwards. Haven't had enough coffee yet. Questions? Now here's the thing. Had the Europeans throughout the rest of the continent studied this event, millions and millions of people's lives would not have been lost over the next 100 years. But they didn't learn from their history. Amongst the area that saw the most destruction was that vast empire in the middle of the continent, which lasted all the way up to the Napoleonic Wars, the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire encompassed much of modern Denmark, Germany, Poland, Hungary, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Italy. It was a big, loose-knit conglomeration of hundreds of states, some big as kingdoms, some small as city-states. Ruling over that vast domain was somebody who I mentioned when I was talking about Luther. Charles V. Now, Charles V, as I mentioned, was also the king of Spain. So he was, in theory and reality, the most powerful monarch in European history. Because of the sheer percentage of the continent that he controlled, the sheer numbers of population he controlled, and the money that circulated in his domains. Now, Charles didn't start the wars within his realm, but rather the people did. It was within the Holy Roman Empire, after all, where Saxony was, the state that Luther lived in. And technically, Charles was Luther's sovereign. But Luther was allowed to write his ideas and circulate his ideas, and many people embraced his ideas. But the problem with religion is that if you are too into your faith, you can become fanatical. So it started breaking out literally in towns at the local level was that Protestants began attacking their Catholic neighbors. And Catholics started attacking their Protestant neighbors.
Crime, violence, assaults, arson, murder
was all taking place in the name of Jesus. Although the funny thing is I believe if you read scripture, Jesus literally says, love thy neighbor. But what do I know? I guess you're not supposed to love your neighbor if he doesn't go to a particular building to pray. I don't know. But the violence started steamrolling. Things reached a critical point when many of the Protestant nobles, fearing a Catholic response, would organize a political alliance called the Schmalkaldic League. And they would unite, as they proclaimed, for their own defense. To compound things, they also made alliances with the political enemies of the emperor. They formed an alliance with France and Denmark. So from 1531 all the way up to 1546, like a snowball. Localized events got out of control. It became more violent. Catholics drove Protestants out of their towns and vice versa. And no one was trying to stop it. That was until it reached the point when the emperor, fed up with the violence, would declare war. Because he was the king of Spain, as well as the emperor, he brought in Spanish soldiers, particularly experienced veterans, conquistadors, who had a lot of battlefield experience suppressing the Aztecs and the Incas, brought them in and joined them with his Austrian and other Catholic forces. Over the course of the next year, again, the wars weren't constant battles, by the way. But over the course of this year plus, there would be two major battles. And in both instances, the Catholic forces wiped the field of the Protestants. Simply because Charles had more men and more equipment. So, what happened? What happens when you win a war? What do you get to do to the loser? What do the winners get to do to the losers?
Gloat
and do what else? Take their stuff and what else? Tell them how it's going to be. You know, one of the bizarre things that have occurred throughout my lifetime is that, well, pretty much ever since Korea, you know, the United States has gone in and fought wars, and then we decided once the war was over we were going to build back up the bad guys. I don't get that. But back then, no. The winners imposed terms on the losers. And there would be a settlement that would be signed at the city of Augsburg, that today historians refer to as the Augsburg Interim. Of course, it was meant to be a permanent settlement of the tensions that resulted in the war. Because Charles, the Catholic king, won, all of the Protestant lords had to agree to convert back to Catholicism. They lost, Now you have to come back to the church.
But here's the irony. Even though all of the Protestant lords signed the document because they lost, Charles never enforced it. Because at the very same time this war came to an end, the Ottoman Turks, the Muslims, were marching up the Balkans, going through the former region once known as Yugoslavia, and essentially were invading Europe. So Charles basically kind of said, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Okay, the Protestants, at least they're Christians. So he never forced them to convert. He just kind of ignored it because he wanted to get Protestant soldiers to join with his Catholic soldiers to drive the Turks out of Europe. And they were successful. Although, of course, by the way, during this time, this is also when Constantinople fell to Mehmed the Conqueror. It wouldn't be until the Turks were driven back, temporarily, that tensions of religion would once again rear their ugly head, resulting in a second war of religion within the Holy Roman Empire. The second war, not that you need to remember the years, is known as the War with Maurice of Saxony. Now, here's the thing. Maurice was originally a Catholic, but he converted to Lutheranism. But, despite the fact that he was a Protestant, he never joined the Small Caldic League. This Protestant king actually fought on the side of Charles. So ironically, the Small Caldic League referred to Maurice as Judas. And if we recall, as Dante told us, Judas, a traitor, is reserved eternal punishment in the ninth ring of hell, just within Lucifer's reach. And he can kind of pick them up, pluck them, and use them as chew toy day after day after day. Not a way to spend eternity. All right, so how does this ally, even though he was a Protestant, how does this ally suddenly switch sides? Well, I've already told you. Once the Germans, to keep it simple, defeated the Turks, Charles went back to the Augsburg Interim and started imposing Catholicism. He sent an order to friend and foe alike, including his friend Maurice. And he ordered him to come back to Catholicism and to impose Catholicism on the other Protestant states, to which Maurice said no. That was the tipping point. So he switched sides, joining an anti-Habsburg, going against the emperor, league. Because, unlike most of the other Protestant leaders, he was actually an experienced war leader. He became the figurehead of resistance against the emperor. And many Protestant states joined with him. To make matters worse, so did France. So now imagine for me this. The red-ish areas, those are the personal domains of the emperor. The rest of this is the Holy Roman Empire.
most of these states up here were Protestant, including Saxony, which is about here. So the northern states make an alliance, and they drive south, and they start attacking Charles's forces. At the same time, France, who's an ally, invades Germany, and starts attacking the Holy Roman Empire. Well, if that wasn't enough, Mehmed and the Turks renewed their assault. Unlike during the 1540s in the Schmalkaldic War, when it was basically Charles against one enemy, now Charles is fighting three. He's being hit on all sides, and as I have here, essentially he is overwhelmed. He went through the critical calculations. Who's the worst threat? He decided ultimately that the Muslims were the worst threat, followed closely by the French. So, what he decides to do is reach out to Maurice and offers a gesture of peace. At the city of Passau in 1552, Maurice and Charles sit down, and once again they do the enemy of my enemy is my friend calculation. Charles grants full legal recognition of Lutheranism. At least they're German. They may not be Catholic, but at least they're German. This was enough to convince Maurice to abandon his alliance with France and would allow the German states to join with Charles and fight against the Turks, which in 1554 they once again drove out of Germany. Then they turned their forces and they dealt with the French and drove them out as well. Once the wars were done, all of the German princes would gather once again in Augsburg, and they would sign the document meant to end the wars of religion in the Holy Roman Empire, 30 years after they began. The Peace of Augsburg. 30 years of fighting. Hundreds of thousands of lives were lost. People had homes destroyed. They had their businesses destroyed. And of course, they outright died. But in the end, this document was signed. The basis of which was the same basis that the Wars of Capella ended on. Cuius regio, eius religio. Whose rule? His religion. So simply put, if you live in a Protestant state, you can be a Protestant. But if you live in a Catholic state, you're a Catholic. It's up to the leader to decide. Questions? Now, the smart thing to have done was to learn from what happened in Switzerland. Thousands died. Not learning from what happened in Germany, which was hundreds of thousands. But if you missed the first example, well, we now have a second example within two lifetimes, two generations, that should have caused the people in Europe to sit back and say, you know something, trying to kill one another over religion is stupid. But human beings are not smart. We're all creatures of habit, which makes us dumb. and I include myself in that.
Mrs. Professor Lemanic tells me that every day.
Because just as the dust was settling in one major power, the Holy Roman Empire, the inferno erupted in another, France. And the battle lines were the same. Catholics versus Protestants. But the difference was, it was a different version of Protestantism. In Switzerland, the Protestants were members of the Swiss Reformed Church, Zwingli's Church. In Germany, or the Holy Roman Empire, the Protestants were mostly Lutherans. In France, the Protestants, known as Huguenots, were Calvinists. The Huguenots are named after one of the leaders who lived in Geneva, who launched a political revolt against the Catholics during the Second War of Capel. It's where Geneva switched from being a Catholic canton to a Protestant canton. Bassignon Hugh was the leader. So, the people who embraced Calvinism in France adopted his name as a revolutionary leader. And they sought to do the same. They wanted to flip France from being Catholic to Protestant. So what does this mean? Well, if you remember what we said about Calvinism, Calvinism is a localized religious movement. It's in many ways democratic. It's the church is controlled by the members of the church. It's bottom up, not like the Catholic model where it's top down. So these Calvinists, essentially Huguenots, wanted to create their own religious communities. But ironically, the movement would also touch upon political and economic discontent. There were many people in France that were frustrated by the way France was run. The king had all the power, and the king shared power with his close friends. And if you were not in that inner circle, you basically got screwed. The laws were stacked against you, economic opportunity was stacked against you, and you basically would have a very rough life. So these Huguenots wanted liberation. Yes, religiously. Yes, spiritually. But they also wanted political and economic liberation. High prices, high taxes was crushing. By the outbreak of violence in the 1560s, it's estimated that about 15% of the population had converted to this new religion. But 50% of the nobles had converted. So 15% of the overall population, but half of the powerful political class. And these Calvinists sought to use their religion as a weapon against the crown. Questions? Now, in the 1540s, 1550s, 1560s, as this Calvinistic movement is growing, two factions appeared. There was a Protestant faction, and there was a Catholic faction. The Protestant faction
would be led by one of the most powerful nobles in the southern part of France.
The Duke of Bourbon.
Of course, the irony is this would be the exact opposite of what took place in Germany, or the Holy Roman Empire, and Switzerland. In those two countries, Protestantism was in the north, and Catholicism was in the south. Well, in France, Protestantism was in the south, and Catholicism would be in the north.
And the leader of the northern faction was the second most powerful family in France at the time. The Bourbons were strong, but De Guise, the family of Guise, they were juggernauts. The leader of the family, the Duke, he was the king's commander of the French army. And two of the Duke's brothers were cardinals, heads of the church in France. They controlled the military, they had the ear of the king, and they controlled the church. Powerful. But what do all men in power want? They want more. So in France, you can't become king. So the second opportunity to get more power is to advise the king. So these two factions were all about who could sit by the king's side. Because if you sit by the king's side, you'll get the rewards. Now, unfortunately, the wars in France would be triggered by the death of one person, a king. In 1559, King Henri II died jousting. He went to celebrate the marriage of his 13-year-old daughter to the son of Charles V, who ironically was Philip, who would become Philip II, who later would marry Mary Tudor, Queen of England. Henri's death was tragic. You all know about jousting? I've definitely tempered my physical engagements as I got older, because I realized that life is precious and people have a tendency to go squish. But when I was young, I did crazy things. I jumped off bridges, skydived, bungee cord. I had no fear. But the one thing, and never in my wildest dreams would I ever want to do, is joust. Imagine for me this. You put on 100+ pounds of steel armor. So heavy you can't climb onto the back of a horse, but rather they have to use a crane and hoist you up and put you on the horse. And we're not talking a little horse, we're talking a huge, massive war horse. You are then given a shield and a long piece of wood with a point at the end. Although usually the point has some type of buffer on it, so that way it's not sharp. Oftentimes, if you see medieval lances, there's like a copper topper on it, and it usually sometimes looks like a hand. The idea is you want to push rather than pierce. But anyways, you have your shield, you have your lance, and there's a guy on the other side doing the exact same thing. Typically, one of the women in the crowd will stand up
and drop the handkerchief. And that's the sign of the go. It's like the old-fashioned checkered flag. Then you kick your horse in the side and you get going as fast as you can. Horses go like 25, 30 miles an hour. And you're sitting there and you're aiming at your opponent. The idea is you take your lance, you want to hit them square in the shield and either knock the shield out of his hands or, better yet, knock him off his horse. The problem is in order for that to happen, everything has to go perfectly. And one of the biggest things, if you read about these tournaments where people ended up dying, was because of the shield. If you tilt it a little too far one way or another, that's going to impact how the lance goes. Apparently, the king had the shield in a jerked position, so when his opponent's lance struck it, it burst and a shard of wood went like a bullet right through his eye socket on his helmet and embedded itself into his skull. Poor bastard didn't die instantaneously. He fell off his horse and it would take him a couple of days to die because the wound got infected. But now the king is dead. Fortunately, he did his kingly duty. He had not one, not two, but three sons. So when he died, no big deal. His son was named king. But look at him. Look at Francois. He was a boy of just 15 years old. So when a child becomes king, it's common to appoint somebody to rule the kingdom until the king comes of age. We call that person a regent. Now, because the nobles were divided, the compromise that was reached was we are going to let the queen mother serve as regent. Henri's wife was not French, but Italian, from the powerful, powerful banking family that we talked about, de Medici. So, on one hand, she was a foreigner. On the other, she was a Catholic. So, in her regency, she started listening more to De Guise than Bourbon. On a side note, interesting little factoid, one of the things that Catherine did was arrange a marriage for Francois, because you can't be a king without having a queen. So Francois was actually married to none other than a woman we're going to talk about, maybe not today, but definitely next week. Mary, Queen of Scots. We might get to her today. She was 16. He was married when he was 14. So everything's all set. He's king. He's got a wife. Now all he's got to do is make it to maturity. Unfortunately, the poor kid died of a really bad earache, ear infection. So now, in a span of a year and a half, France loses not just one king, but a second. Obviously, this kid had no heirs. But, like I said, Henri had three sons. So the next boy up was Charles. He would be crowned in 1516. But Charles was even younger. I should have put
coronation picture on there.
This was what he looked like around the time of his death.
Charles became king at 9 years old.
And this time, Bourbon was not happy with the fact that all of the nobles agreed to have a neutral regent, but this regent was doing the bidding of the Catholics. So, during his reign, which would last for 14 years, poor kid himself died at the age of 23. Not one, not two, but three wars would erupt in France between the Protestant houses and the Catholic houses. During the first war, the Catholics launched a swift, undeclared attack on the Huguenots because the Bourbons apparently were plotting to kidnap the king, to free the king from the Catholic clutches. But the Huguenots managed to fight back, and the first war ended in a draw. The second war erupted when the Protestants preemptively attacked the Catholics, because rumors were swirling that the Catholics were planning another attack. Catholics, however, fought back, because again, 50-50, you ended up with another draw. But the Protestants managed to kill more Catholics than Catholics killed Protestants. So, if anything, slight edge to the Protestants. Ultimately, a third war broke out when the Catholics refused to accept the terms that were agreed to in the second war. To make matters worse, the third war during the reign of Charles kind of almost became like a world war. England and the Netherlands helped the Protestants, whereas Spain, Tuscany, and the Pope himself hated the Catholics. First war, a couple hundred people died. Second war, few tens of thousands of people died. Third war, six digits. Hundreds of thousands. But in the end, even this war ended in a draw. So, because of the constant violence and destruction, the queen would attempt to intervene. Because while all this was going on, she only wanted one thing. She didn't care which side won. She wasn't French. She was Italian. But the one thing she wanted was to make sure that no one would overthrow her son. So, what does this mean? Well, she, for example, would give in and would appoint some Protestants to influential positions. But of course, that meant firing Catholics. And when the Catholics were fired, they got angry. To make matters worse, she would arrange a marriage between her daughter Margaret to the Duke of Bourbon, Henri Bourbon. But when the Catholics were all up in arms, she decides to raise taxes and pay Catholics for damages, but not the Protestants. So again, by the way, if any of you ever think about going into politics on any level, this is reality. No matter what you do, you're going to anger half the people. So the queen was in a lose-lose situation, but the more she did, the more she made things worse. Proof? Proof of this took place the day after the wedding of Margaret to Henri Bourbon. On August 24th, St. Bartholomew's Day, Huguenots were in the city celebrating the marriage of the princess and the duke. But there was an assassination attempt on the duke by Catholic agents. So, all of the city was put on lockdown. But that was just a trick. Because once the city was locked down and everyone was told, stay off their streets, stay in your homes, the Catholic guards let Catholic troops from De Guise into Paris, and they literally began going house to house where all the Protestants were staying and murdering them all in broad daylight. In just one day, 3,000 Protestants were killed on the streets of Paris alone. And over the next few days, upwards of 30,000 Protestants were murdered throughout France. This would ignite a fourth war that would continue on for almost two decades. Questions? Well, one of the casualties in the war was the king. Charles IX would die because food supplies were disrupted and a famine erupted. But fortunately, when Charles died in 1574, even though he did not have an heir, the third and last son of Henri II was still alive. He is Henri III. And when Henri comes to the throne at 25, so there's no need for a regent, ironically, he would find himself embattled in this war of religion that historians refer to as the final stage, as the War of Three Henrys. Because Henri, in French, was the name of all three significant leaders. The king was Henri III, the head of De Guise, the duke, was Henri de Guise, and the head of the Bourbon faction was Henri de Bourbon. Now, unfortunately, Henri III, even though he was an adult, was an experienced king. Since he was about 15, he was shipped off to Poland because there was an opening on the throne of Poland. So his mom made a deal where the Poles elected him to become king. So for about 9 years, he had been reigning as the king of Poland. But the problem was, is for those 10 years, he didn't speak a word of French. All he spoke was Polish. He adopted Polish-style clothing. He adopted Polish food. So when his brother died and he was invited to come back and be king of France, he essentially was a foreigner in a strange land. So as a result, even though he was no longer a child, he had to rely upon the nobles. And he decided to put his trust in De Guise. So, initially, the war involved an alliance of two Henrys against the third.
Now, for the first several years, it wasn't like combat. There would be tensions. There might be street violence. Maybe a town would engage in it. But there were no major armies marching across France. It was more of a state of war. But that changed in the 1580s. Because by the 1580s, the king is now getting into his 40s. And even though he was married, failed to produce a male heir, which was required because France was a Catholic country. Ironically, this potentially meant we could have a situation like what triggered the Hundred Years' War. Because the next in line after Henri was Margaret, the daughter of Henri II, who was married to Henri Bourbon. So de Guise formulated a plan. He decided to assassinate the king and take the throne for himself. De Guise would march into Paris with his soldiers against the wishes of the king. Now, de Guise was a superstar among the residents of Paris. So, word spread to the king's ear that the people would rather have de Guise, who was French and Catholic, than Henri, who was more Polish than Catholic. Plus, de Guise had male heirs. So we're talking an all-out coup d'etat. This kind of forced the king's hand. The king decides to preemptively strike. He orders his bodyguards to kill de Guise. And when this occurred, a riot broke out in Paris, which forced the king to flee. But where was the king gonna go? Well, he couldn't stay in Catholic France, so he had to go to Protestant France. And he found himself in the lands of Bourbon. By the way, when Henry fled, Parliament actually would declare the king to be a murderer. So now the king has a choice. I got to stay with the Protestants and I got to help the Protestants win, because if the Protestants don't win, I'm dead. Now, to do so, he actually made an appeal to all of the Protestants. He told them that he was willing to legalize Protestantism, that he would be willing to do something like the Peace of Augsburg, that he would be willing to divide France based on religion. Simultaneously, he also declares that he would be willing to give pardons to any Catholics who were with Guise that came over to his side. Henri has the epiphany that French fighting French over religion is stupid. Because it's not about religion, it's about politics.
Well, the Catholic League would hold out and refuse the terms, which ultimately forced the hand of the king. Marching with Bourbon's army, this alliance force marched towards Paris. They were preparing to lay siege to take the city back when a weird thing occurred. Just as the king was making his plans to attack the city, a friar appeared, a Dominican monk, by the name of Jacques Clément. Now, Clément had false papers, forged, and he claimed he had a vital message for the king that would guarantee a peaceful outcome. Now, somehow, all of the different levels of security fell for the ruse and allowed the priest to enter all the way into the king's tent, holding a bundle of papers. When he entered the tent, he stated that he had this message, the secret message that he had to give to the king. Well, the king signaled to his attendants that he'll just go and get the papers. So he got up off his chair and he walked over to the priest. I mean, after all, he's a priest. When he reached out to get the bundle, Clement bent over and whispered something into the king's ear. And then concealed in his robes was a knife that he would thrust into the stomach of the king.
Killing him! Dead.
Now, unfortunately, we have no idea what Clément was doing. Who paid him? Was he a paid assassin or was he doing this on his own? Because within minutes after killing the king, all of the guards hacked this man to bits. So they didn't question. So we don't know why he did it. But now, not only is Henri de Guise gone, but now Henri III is gone. All of the surviving nobles, both Catholic and Protestant, sit back and they survey the landscape. Since the wars first erupted, during the reign of Charles IX, over 500,000 men, women, children killed in France. Plus, another 500,000 were forced to flee. Some went to Protestant countries, some went to Catholic countries. Some converted to one religion or another. The French economy completely shattered. Again, we're talking nearly 30 years of, for the most part, nonstop violence, death, and destruction. And as if that wasn't bad enough, it ended a ruling line that had been ruling France for 260 years. The Valois dynasty came to an end. So when it was all said and done, the nobles exhausted, the people exhausted, they decided to do something that was shocking. They decided to elect Henri Bourbon, a Huguenot, to be the king of France. And he would be crowned Henri IV. It would be his bloodline that would rule France for the rest of its centuries of monarchy. All the way up until the French Revolution of 1840. His bloodline would also have a offshoot that would take over the throne of Spain. And the current king of Spain is of his line. And what gave him the right? Well, because of marriage. France decided that whole through a woman thing, yeah, we're not going to care about that anymore. But here's the thing. 85% of his population was Catholic. So what does the king do as a token to the majority of his subjects? He converts to Catholicism. But to protect the Protestants, he would pass a document known as the Edict of Nantes. It didn't give Protestants full freedom. France was still a Catholic nation. But it bestowed upon them legal protections. So it wasn't a full-blown quos regeo eos religio, but instead it would give the Protestants the legal right to practice their faith openly and not have to worry about being killed. But here's the sad thing. By the time the Edict of Nantes was passed, as a result of all of the destruction, for 30 years of war. By the way, we in our entire history of our country have never been embroiled in a war for 30 years. The longest war was when our soldiers were in Afghanistan. That lasted for nearly 20. Actually, it was more than 20. Now, when did Biden fuck up the withdrawal? That was 2021. I think we had boots on the ground in 2003. So almost 20 years. But imagine 30. We've never had war on our soil for that long. Well, the truth of the matter is, by this point, upwards of 90% of the Protestants ceased to live in France. So that 15% was reduced down to single digits. And France would remain officially a Catholic state until the French revolution. Questions? Wow, this is good stuff. No? I do a better job talking about it than the book does. The chapter in the book on this is kind of boring. All right. We'll start one more and we'll call it a class. Nike's shit. Missed that. Sorry. Damn, why isn't my phone on? 6:21. Yeah. I'll miss it. All right. Anyways, England. As we know, there would be no internal war of religion in England because Elizabeth settled it. She brought Catholicism and Protestants together in the Church of England. She united her people to be nationalistic, to love their country, but not worry about killing one another over faith. But in England, during Elizabeth's reign, she would face external threats. Because there were Catholics that wanted to take her throne and force England to be Catholic again. I'm going to give you one because I got enough time to talk about it, and we'll do the other one when we come back next week. The first deals with an attempted usurpation of the throne by her cousin, the aforementioned Mary, Queen of Scots. Now, Mary was, by law, by the Act of Succession of 1543, passed by Henry VIII, was her heir, at least until Elizabeth had a child. Elizabeth, unfortunately, would die in 1603 without a child, which is the reason why she was referred to as the Virgin Queen. Was she actually a virgin? Don't know. Probably. But I have no way to know for sure, because no events were ever recorded. But anyways. So if you recall, under the Act of Succession, first went to Edward, then it went to Mary, then it went to Elizabeth, and then it went to the descendants of Henry's sister. Mary's grandmother was Margaret, Henry's sister. Margaret was married to the King of Scotland, who had a son, who then gave birth, well, his wife gave birth to Mary. But there were no brothers. Scotland, like England, became a Protestant country, so the idea of having a woman as sovereign was no big deal in the eyes of the Scots. So she, in fact, would become queen. But the problem is, Scotland, tiny, primitive, backwards. England wasn't much better, but it had a bigger economy. So Mary sits back and thinks, wouldn't it be better if I was Queen of England? I mean, after all, I'm next in line. So if an unfortunate accident would occur to my cousin, I could become queen. For several years, she meddled, including hiring assassins. One of the most famous assassination attempts was she would send a poisoned girdle to her cousin. Of course, she didn't say it was poisoned. If you ever see the fashion trends, take a look at Elizabeth. Look how small her waist is. Actually, you really can't see it, but if you will look up close, you can see behind there is the fabric of the throne. Women used to put these girdle things on, and literally it took two people to pull the tie, pull the strings back, to force the ideal medieval body, our shape, So, okay to be big at the shoulders, big at the boobs, but when you get down at the waist, it's got to be like yay thin, which is impossible to do naturally. So you suck in the gut. And then, of course, wide hips suggest good birthing ability. Well, in order for the girdle to work, it was typically had rigid holders in them, commonly made out of bone, which everything I read makes me glad I was never a woman during the medieval period, because they were uncomfortable beyond imagination. Well, Mary sent her one that had poisoned barbs. So when you pulled the girdle tight, the barbs popped out and jabbed you from about here all the way down your stomach. Fortunately, one of Elizabeth's lady-in-waiting decided to try on the queen's clothes one night and just happened to pick the girdle that had the poison in it. It was bad. It was crazy. But in the end, Mary did not love her cousin. But unfortunately for Mary, she got herself in trouble. Because Mary, among other issues, was a whore. She liked sleeping around. And long story short, the nobles didn't want a whorish queen. So they kicked her off the throne and gave it to her son, one-year-old James, who would be crowned James VI. Now, long story short, she had nowhere else to go because she was once married to Francis II, King of France, but he died when she was still a girl. So she had nowhere else to go. So she literally fled into the arms of Elizabeth. Elizabeth agreed to give her sanctuary But unfortunately, the queen got caught, Mary, got caught sending communiques to the Pope, who at the time was a guy by the name of Sixtus V, in which she basically said to the Pope, "Pope, if you give my blessing, or a blessing to me, I will lead a revolution, overthrow Elizabeth, and bring England back to Catholicism." Well, unfortunately, the messages got intercepted. Because you know what they didn't have? Wireless communication technology. So the letters were caught. She gets put on trial for treason, found guilty, and got beheaded. She lost her head, which would eliminate one threat. But just to leave us off, because I know I'm over, when the Pope found out that a queen, Catholic queen, but a queen, was killed by another queen, he declared that to be an act, proof that England is contaminated by the devil. Heretics. And England needed to be purged. So what does he do? He sends word out to a powerful Catholic king and says, "Hey, if you invade England, you can have it."
But we'll deal with that on Tuesday. So, for those of you who came later, I mentioned it to those who were here in the beginning. Papers, papers, papers. That deadline's creeping forward. So if you want to try to get extra credit, it's due next week. Another thing, we are almost done. Not going to have an exam before Easter, but chances are it will be immediately when we come back from Easter weekend. So if you've missed any classes, make sure you listen to the recordings. All right? Have a wonderful weekend. Stay warm. It's going to be cold. And we'll see you all on Tuesday. What? Can you see him? I thought I turned it on.
I can't see mine.
I might have hit the wrong button. I will deal with it. I'm sorry.